25% water, and the rest is just...
John Tukaru, May 2019, musculoskeletal.
Inorganic and organic. So, and the skeletal system in our body has got an amazing way of rebuilding, repairing, creating more bone. So, in theory, your body replaces your whole skeletal system in 7 years, and is constantly taking away bone and rebuilding bone at the same time. And your body's got a lovely way of maintaining that equilibrium. If you could just turn off the little phone things and that, because they distract me a little bit. I don't mind you recording. And so that system of equilibrium with the minerals in your skeletal system can go a bit skew-whiff. And there are a lot of conditions that can be affected that way. And you get the, for example, osteoporosis. Both men and women get it, but it's more prevalent with women because with regards to the menopause and the decrease in the estrogen, you've got various sexual hormones that maintain you as a girl and maintain you as a bloke. But with regards to menopause, as the estrogen level decreases, your rate of absorption and reabsorption of bone changes. So you can become osteopenic, you get osteoporosis. Men get it as well, as the decrease in testosterone occurs, but that occurs much later than women with regards to hormonal levels. And then you get a change in your absorption, reabsorption within your skeletal system of your bone. So you get brittle bones. Okay, so two types of bone. You've got compact and calcaneous bone. You've got a structure, a little anatomical structure there of what bone looks like. And it's like sponge. And there are a lot of functions that the bones do for us. And one of them is in the red bone marrow. And they're usually found in long bones. So this is a femur. So you'll have red bone marrow inside your bone, and they make red blood cells. And also with that, you get some of the clotting factors that are also made, as well as in the liver. Remember when we talked about the liver, how the liver creates some clotting factors for your blood to be sticky, and so you don't hemorrhage to death if you knock yourself? You also have some of those factors made in the long bones. So, a bone's got an outer covering, it's called the periosteum. Sometimes if you knock yourself really hard on your bone, you can get a bruise of the outside of the bone. And a lot of people think that's a reaction, like a fracture or whatever, but bone's really, really strong, but you can still bruise the outside and create a real big lump. So if you see patients, clients with funny things, as a result to a big bump, it's usually that. But you can't dismiss that it might not be a fracture. With fractures, as acupuncturists, we never needle people with broken bones unless it's been previously discussed. Because you don't want to introduce the risk of infection to a broken bone and then getting osteomyelitis or septicemia. Osteomyelitis is infection of the bone, and it's very, very difficult to treat because bone doesn't have a big blood supply. It's really hard to treat infection of the bone, and you don't want to introduce that with any needling. Okay, so bones are our bodies are incredible because all our bones are designed for attachment as well. So you've got lots of little knobbly bits where the ligaments, tendons attach, because ligaments are the end result of a muscle and tendons as well. And you've got lots of different types of bones. You've got long bones, you've got short bones, you've got irregular bones, flat bones, and you've got sesamoid bones. And those are the bones, for example, in your wrist, because in your wrist you've got about 8 lovely bones. I won't go into detail, and some of them slide over one another. Some of them articulate like this. Some are like ball and soccer. And you've got a listing of all the different types of joints there as well. And some of the functions of the body, of the skeletal system, you know, it creates a framework for your body. It forms boundaries, like you've got your skull. Your rib cage is to protect your vital organs, your heart, your lungs, and gives you ability for movement, as well as creating blood cells in the bone marrow. So lots of different types of joints, all self-explanatory. I'll let you look through that. And the thing that I want to focus on with regards to joints are the synovial joints. They're beautiful. Even the little synovial joints in your spine, in your facet joints of your spine, where the top vertebra articulates with the bottom and above, these little joints here, they're encapsulated. So there's a capsule around those joints with little fibers, muscle fibers crisscrossing, going straight across, and there's fluid inside. And they're just beautiful. In my work, this is what I get hooked up on, because often enough people sprain or strain those little facet joints in their back, and that's where I help them realign their spine, improve healing, and speeding the whole process up. Okay, so with joints, you've got lots of in synovial joints, you've got lots of structures inside. You've got ligaments, for example, in your knee that crisscross. You've got collateral ligaments that go on the side, and cruciate as well. And then we can move on to the, you've got a diagram there of a knee, a cross section of a knee. So this is the bottom section here of your femur. So looking at muscle tissue, there's three main types of muscles. You've got smooth muscle, and they're usually found in your intestine. It lines your intestines. You've got cardiac muscle, and you've got skeletal muscle. Now, skeletal muscle does lots of stuff. It enables you to move. But also, remember when we touched upon venous blood return and back to the heart? It's the skeletal muscles that we use with movement that squeeze the blood through your veins back up to your leg, from your legs to your heart. Because veins have got valves, and when you push, they open and then they close, so you don't get blood flowing back. If you get blood flowing back, you start getting those little varicose veins. And like, you know, I'm 56 and I've got some of those little veins on my legs because I've spent my whole life on my feet. So those skeletal muscles massage the veins so that the blood goes back up. So it has lots of function. The way that muscles work, it's all to do with a change in polarity. That means going from a high concentration of various salts to a low concentration, and that's how you get the muscles going. I've got it explained here with your muscle function and how it works. I'll leave you to explore and read more on that, because it's pretty basic anatomy, physiology. Because I want to concentrate on some of the diseases that you will find in your work as acupuncturist. And you know, within acupuncture, you can actually have subdivisions of specialities. Mine is the musculoskeletal system. So we're going to look at osteoarthritis. Osteoarthritis. What is it? What do you know about osteoarthritis? What do you think it's all about? Because whenever anybody hears arthritis, they think of you know, things being really bad. And that it's like that rheumatoid arthritis that's really, really painful and uncomfortable. The other name for osteoarthritis, and what I use in practice, because I don't like to make people worry so much, and I like to make them feel a bit more comfortable with their issues rather than giving them too many labels, and I call it wear and tear. We've all got it happening. From the age of about 20, 25, we start getting wear and tear in our lumbar spine and our cervical spine. And does anybody understand why that be? Why those two areas? And it's usually...
You move them a lot.
Yeah, you move them a lot. But also because, you know, as osteopaths, physios, massage therapists, chiropractors, we all understand the relationship between the cervical spine and the lumbar spine. our spine is designed, I don't know what your religious beliefs are, if it's God or the universe, it's amazing, because whatever's happening here in your cervical spine, neck, and your lumbar spine, lower back, they always happen at the same. And we call it the lover-brother relationship, and it's absolutely beautiful. So for example, if you were to be, heaven forbid, in a car accident, and you have a whiplash where your head goes forward and back really quickly, you most probably have pain in your neck first. Then 3 days or 2 or 3 days later, it happens in your lower back. You can't have anything happening here without it affecting it here. I'm making a point of that because when you're in full practice, you need to always consider that if you're dealing with somebody with cervical issues or lumbar issues. But you'll gain that experience as you go along and be able to work out what the problem is, because you've got to diagnose as well. And there's lots of differential diagnoses for neck pain and back pain. You've got your musculoskeletal things, issues, but then you also have other issues that could be causing that. Like for example, with the neck. I see a lot in practice, people clenching their teeth a lot, or they grind their teeth a lot at night. They don't even know they're doing it, but they're wearing away their teeth and they're really stressed. And that affects what's happening in your neck. That's very specific. And it can also be referred into your clavicles. And incidentally, those people usually have very tight hamstrings and calves. It's very unusual. Anyway, let's get on to osteoarthritis. So osteoarthritis, it sounds really bad, but it's just wear and tear. And if you're going to talk about that stuff with your patients or clients, try and keep it light, because people, the general public, don't always understand rheumatoid arthritis, which is the big inflammatory disease, and osteoarthritis. But GPs tend to use OA, osteoarthritis, a lot. Okay, so you've got the percentages of female, males, the prevalence of it all, the etiology, that means how it occurs. I've given you that information. So the thing that differs between osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis is that rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease usually. And some people have got the gene, and the gene is, it's BH something, I forgot. Maybe I've got it in my notes, I forgot. Some people have the factor in their genetic makeup, or the rheumatoid factor in their makeup, but sometimes it gets activated, sometimes it doesn't. So you could be a carrier of that particular gene that predisposes you to rheumatoid arthritis, but you don't have anything happen to trigger that activation. Now, there's strong links with rheumatoid arthritis and other diseases. So if you happen to have psoriasis, does anybody know what that is? Everybody knows what that is? Yeah, you know, your risk factors for rheumatoid arthritis is increased by 50%. Because it's an autoimmune disease. Autoimmune means that your body is actually fighting something to cause that disease process. It's when your immunity gets a little bit skew-whiff. It's not nice if it blows up into full-blown rheumatoid arthritis and you've got the acute inflammation. Because there's very little to do, there's very little that you can do to control that process. The use of steroids is crucial to reduce the inflammation, but with steroid use you get a lot of other side effects. Remember how we talked about some of the side effects of steroids last time? Do you remember what some of the side effects are? Yeah, that's right. The term for that is Cushing's syndrome. And you get the moon face, you get the soft downy fur hair on if you're a woman. You can have bulgy eyes a little bit. You can puffy neck, you retain a lot of fluid. Okay, so you've got some etiology about rheumatoid arthritis. It's actually more common in females than males. It's usually unilateral, so you know, it's usually both sides of the body rather than osteoarthritis being, you know, your dominant side. Yeah? So you can read through that. And I've given you some signs and symptoms. They're very similar to osteoarthritis, except with rheumatoid arthritis, when you touch, remember, you know, with our when we treat somebody, we look at them first, and then we touch them, and you can feel the heat. Has anybody known anybody with rheumatoid arthritis when they have a flare-up? It's really, really painful. And it's very hard to manage that discomfort. But the key is to treat the symptoms, manage the pain or the discomfort, and there's lots of old-fashioned things that I actually still support with my patients. Because if you give them some control of the disease process, apart from the Western stuff, it just makes them happier, I think, and they're more compliant. Okay.
Can you help prevent flare-ups with diet?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of... I have one patient with really bad rheumatoid arthritis, and they're on an anti-inflammation diet.
Yeah.
But it's so restrictive. But he's had an amazing response to that.
Things like tomatoes are supposed to be really bad, aren't they?
They're very acidic.
Yeah.
It's linked
what
to
is,
very...
What is the diet you put?
You know what, it's very it's an alkaline diet, and it's very bland, and it's very raw. You don't have any processed food. You can look up, I didn't give that to you as well, but you can look into it. Yeah. But it's really interesting, because it does work. When you
when I treat rheumatoid arthritis, like you just said in the diet, one of the things I'll say to the people, do they know their blood type? Because whether you believe it or not, it's good to say to them to eat right for your blood type, simply because tomatoes is a major one that may be a factor. I've seen people coming out of tomatoes for a few days and actually been able to move their hands.
Uh-huh.
But luckily enough, we're able to test it before and show them. But nevertheless, an orange juice is another one.
Yep.
But if you look at the blood type, then what happens is there's inflammatory foods and whatever. And I never ever, like you just said, John, sometimes you can go too deep. But I would never ever say to them to actually look at the whole book, because it will actually blow them away.
It's too much,
It's too much. So all I'm interested in is look at the avoidance list and look what you're eating in the avoidance list. And then you can sort of eliminate some things from there. And you're absolutely right, because I've seen it time and time again. The diet is a major factor, because I'm going to have to cook as well, but also if it works more.
I'd like to just say something as well. Like, when we treat rheumatoid, often we used to get people when they've got pain all over the body and it suddenly flares up. And then because rheumatoid is an autoimmune disease, it's quite often that they've actually caught a virus.
Yes.
And so our main treatment is actually to do the antiviral herbal formulas with the purgative, and then you get a whole knock-on effect on all the inflammation all over the body, and it reduces everywhere. And then if we do like auricular acupuncture, do the helix points, because that's lowers the body temperature and improves the immunity. And then also we strengthen the kidney. So, and that, in my experience, has worked very well.
Sure,
it's all the same kind of thing.
And also I actually use a lot of the Schengen to control pain.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when people get a cycle of pain, it's very, very difficult to get them off that merry-go-round. And it's very consuming. If you have persistent pain from that never stops, it's really, really hard to stop somebody from continuing to get stressed with it and exaggerates it even further. So breaking that pain cycle is crucial. And that's where, as practitioners, you can help people. But like Annie and Paul said, it's a combination of lots of things. And everybody's different. That's the thing I've got to stress to you. Not one thing fits all sizes. You've got to always look at your patients, your clients, as individuals. Remember we talked about it before? You know, not one size fits all.
Yeah.
And you've got to understand too, with stress, your body's producing hormones, stress hormones called corticosteroids. And those same corticosteroids that you produce in your stress also impede your healing. It stops your healing. So you can actually cause a lot of diseases, and it's been proven, especially with regards to malignancy, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, heart problems. She's already got one. So, all I'm asking you is not to be a psychologist, but to be thinking about the patient's, your client's psyche. Sometimes you've got to click into people and diffuse that. And if you get them talking about the stress factors, if you've got the time, I make the time for my patients. It actually benefits not just your patient, but you, because you understand them a little bit more. You always got to make that connection with your patients and your clients. And it can be quite light and fluffy, but when they understand that you understand, you get more compliance. They're more likely to go home, follow making their herbs, doing their tinctures, making those adjustments to their diet. And when you do that, when they do that, it gives them more control over their disease or their problem. They have more control, they've got more compliance. It's really that basic. But you've got to be sympathetic and supportive all the time. I will say, I always find that love in my heart for people, because if you do, it's beneficial for everybody, you as a practitioner and for your patients or clients. Okay, now, I want to talk about fibromyalgia, because that's a really difficult thing, because, you know, in Western medicine, they use that as a label for a lot of things when they don't quite understand what the problem is with somebody. Yeah, and I don't know if anybody has had experience with that with their family or their mum or dad, because fibromyalgia is actually a collection of symptoms, and it's always in association with other things like sleep problems, IBS. IBS is another disease that Western medicine practitioners, GPs, label people with without understanding the whole. Without looking at the whole person. When they're a little bit like unsure, they give them a label. They do that a lot. And it's not their fault, it's just the way that the system works. And sometimes GPs are under a lot of pressure. We've got to be a bit more sympathetic for them these days. And they'll just give somebody a label, like fibromyalgia. But fibromyalgia is a collection of symptoms, and it can be chronic headaches, insomnia, anxiety, irritable bowel. Once again, these are all things caused by stress. So you've got to always look at your client, your patients, and look at the stress that they're under. Part of my consultation, I have a little section in my my patient record card, and I always ask people, you know, what's going on in your life? Have you had any major bereavements, divorces, house moves? Those are the biggest things that cause a lot of people stress, and of course work. Yeah, a lot of people find work difficult. Okay, so I'll leave you to read through that. But incidentally, with osteoarthritis and with fibromyalgia, we really encourage activity. With rheumatoid arthritis, it's limited because of somebody's discomfort. But even they should be moving. Once they're comfortable, they've got to keep moving. Gone are the days where you lie in bed and do nothing. You've got to keep moving. For example, with sprains and strains, like with the knee, ankle, wrists, before they'll just, you know, immobilize you. Like you do the rest, you know. You rest, elevate, ice. But now, the idea is that you keep moving. You don't even use the support anymore, because that helps the healing process. Because when you put a support on a joint, elbow, knee, whatever, you're immobilizing it, protecting it, giving it nice, making it nice and tight so that it feels comfortable, but you're actually weakening the muscles above and below, so the joint becomes even more unstable. And it impedes the lymphatic drainage. Remember we talked about the circulations in the body. The lymphatic system collects all the rubbish in the body, packages it, and gets rid of it. We're going to cover that when we do circulation later on in the year. Okay, so you've got some information about fibromyalgia. So we're going to work from the top. We're going to work from the neck downwards, and we'll talk about some of the basic things that you'll be seeing in practice. And you see a lot of it. But I need you to remember, everything that we talk about, there may be a medical reason for that problem too. And you're not going to gain that experience until you're in practice to work out if it's musculoskeletal or if it's another underlying medical problem. And you always got to have your thinking cap on that it could be something else. Now, with Google, patients do all that, put in all their symptoms, and they get told what's wrong with them. It really annoys me. Because, you know, I'm the person that they're coming to see. I'm actually deemed an expert after 5 years of being in practice. And you'll be too, as acupuncturist and herbalist. So you've got to be calm. When somebody says, ah, I think I've got a sprain in my neck, or I think I've got a torticollis, and they're like this, and you think, well, maybe they're right. You've got to be very kind and patient, but just let them say what they think, and then you've got to put that aside and look yourself and do your diagnosis, however you choose to do it. And remember, we always start with observation, palpation, and range of motion stuff. Yeah? So, cervical. Now, throughout your handouts, I've got abbreviations for things. I've given you a list of the abbreviations at the very end, so that if you're confused, you refer to the back. Okay, so cervical spine is always CX. Thoracic spine, oh, I should be using this. Thoracic spine, and you've got 12 vertebrae in your thoracic spine, is always TH. Your lumbar spine, you've got 5 beautiful big vertebrae, it's always LX. And then you've got 5 segments to the sacrum, and then of course the coccyx. This spine doesn't have a coccyx, but usually there's very little movement in the coccyx. But can I just tell you, that little coccyx, you know, it's like the remnants of the tail from, you know, evolution, us being monkeys and stuff, is the linchpin for your whole pelvic floor. We'll talk about that, hopefully I'll remember, in a tick. So, cervical spine. Who's ever hurt their neck? Yeah, what happened?
Well, just, like, probably did.
Pardon?
Nothing too serious.
Okay, so no whiplash injury, or you just woke up. Everybody surely has woken up with a crick neck. Yeah? So that's usually just because of the way that you slept, or if you're a grinder, people tend to grind both sides or one side in their sleep. And it can happen. All it is a tightening of the muscles in the neck that cause that sore neck. Sometimes you can have mechanical issues like with a whiplash in a car accident, or you know how some girls like swimming with their head out of the water and not get their hair wet because they don't want, and they do this. Yeah, repeating doing this, and of course they do the leg. Okay, that's like over a long period of time, like a repetitive motion, you get inflammation or a little sprain. So in my world, we don't do breaststroke. We get the head in the water. Yeah, if you can share that with yourselves and your clients and friends, it's really important. Breaststroke is out because it's not good for you.
Is breaststroke like, out even with your head in the water?
That's different.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because you know it's a smoother motion.
Yeah.
You've got to get that in. Yeah. Okay, so we talk about sprain and strain, facet syndrome. That's what we as manipulative therapists talk about, the little muscles in the vertebra, sorry, the little joints in the vertebra. This is a little chunk of lumbar spine. And the facet joints are at the top and the bottom. You can get little inflammation of those little muscles inside the joint. Remember, these are synovial joints, so they're capsulated. And when you get inflammation, you get problems with mobility. Okay. And you can get instability, depending on what happens with the bones. So you've got the spinous processes on the outside and the transverse process on the back. And these are all major attachments to muscles within the spine. You know what, just pass that around. I should have bought a little few more chunks. Doesn't matter. And then of course, DJD is degenerative joint disease, wear and tear again. Okay, everybody's got it. And if you're like me, who worked as a nurse before, working with babies, it was always like this with the cocks, with the babies. And like you get wear and tear starting very young. So reticulopathy, you may not ever use that terminology as in your work, but reticulopathy means referred symptoms. For example, the nerves coming from your cervical spine, it innervates, it goes to about this level of your chest, just above your nipples, and down your arms. So sometimes you can get shooting pains, pins and needles. You can actually determine where the pins and needles are, where the problem is from your neck, which nerve is being impinged. That means having pressure put on it. So you can, pins and needles, what I see a lot of with pins and needles in hands and it's usually due to carpal tunnel syndrome. Does everybody know what carpal tunnel is? So within your wrist, you've got your ulna and your radius, and you've got a little canal where the blood vessels and the nerves go through and other vessels, lymph system as well. With repetitive strain, that means lots of typing, and we don't do that anymore, but you can get inflammation or lots of waving. You get inflammation and that gap, that little canal, becomes narrow and you get tingles in your fingers. A lot of knitters, girls that knit a lot, it's usually girls that knit, people that write a lot, people that type a lot, they tend to get this stuff. Or it's just bad luck. But if you get it with one hand, you usually get it with the other. It's a bit weird. And it's very simple to manage. You'll see that a lot. Right, so that's with reticulopathy. You can get those funny little shooting pains. You get it as well with the lumbar spine. The nerves from the lumbar spine innervate, they go down to your legs. And depending where you've got pins and needles, numbness, tingling, you can determine what level of the spine it's from. And it's called your myotimes or dermatimes. That's the mapping of your body where the nerves innervate the skin and where the nerves innervate the muscles. So, I've been asked to talk about torticollis. You've got acquired torticollis and congenital torticollis. Has anybody seen anybody with a wry neck like this? Yeah, I've seen a lot of babies born like that because of traumatic deliveries. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen a baby being born, but usually a baby is born with a crown first, and then the head is rotated, one shoulder is brought out, and then the other shoulder usually follows because, you know, the birth canal has been widened by the head. But sometimes they yank them. They yank the babies, and they can yank them to the point where they damage the nerves in their neck. It's called a brachial plexus. Brachial plexus palsy, that's the word.
Palsy.
And it's awful, just awful. Most babies get over it, but some people can be left damaged like that forever because they've torn the nerves. Yeah. But with babies, they tend to recover, because remember we talked about babies in passing before, had their little primitive organisms and their little brain and nervous system is growing, you know, for the first 18 months of their life. And they can repair, but older people, it's not that easy.
So they're born wry?
But it's caused by the trauma of the delivery. Okay. And also, the other one is when they use those salad servers, forceps. Yeah, and sometimes a baby's half, you know, so far down the birth canal, there's no turning back unless they do an emergency Caesar, and they use these forceps passing through the mum, through the birth canal, and they try and find the head, they grab on the head and they pull them through. Yeah, it can be very traumatic. I see a lot of babies in my practice that have had traumatic births. And part of my job is to settle them back into their bodies as they grow in those first crucial weeks of life.
Presumably it can also be how they're positioned.
Yeah, that too. That's also as one of the causes in when you look at torticollis in your handout. It's the way that they lie. Sometimes babies lie in utero across, or they might be breach, but they tend not to have develop issues within it. It's when they're lying transverse, you know. And babies do a lot of moving before the 36 weeks comes of pregnancy. Because once a woman is at 36 weeks, there's very little space in her uterus for the baby to move. And so usually the baby is settled, hopefully, head down into the pelvis and engaged for delivery in another 4 weeks. Okay, so torticollis is there. And what I do with my kids, my babies that have problems, I actually only see them three or four times, and then I get the parents to keep them massaging and doing stuff with them to release all this, because you can stretch that and get parents, show them gently how to do it, so that gives them control of their baby a bit more. Yeah, and of course with torticollis you can have real feeding problems, because they'll only want to feed from one breast or feed from one side of the bottle, and the whole idea is to do everything unilaterally with babies, so they don't get too dominant with one side or the other. Okay, so you've got a few little things here about how to manage it, it's for me it's all soft tissue. Okay, so we're going to move down now to the shoulder joint and some of the problems associated with that. I've got lots of tinnituses. Whenever you see a word with itis on the end, it's usually to do with inflammation. And for example, with the bicep muscle, this is the muscle, it's an antagonistic muscle that brings your arm up. It's got two branches of tendon that goes into your shoulder joint, and it's two of those attachments creates the rotator cuff. Have you heard of people talking about their rotator cuff or being torn whenever they've got a shoulder problem? Well, the rotator cuff is made up by all the attachments from all the muscles in your arm into your shoulder. The shoulder joint is a ball and socket joint, but it's very shallow. Unlike the hip, it's a good cup on the ball and it works. But the shoulder, it's very shallow, it's like this. So if it's very shallow, it needs lots of muscular attachment to keep that arm on your chest, because you've got a little shoulder joint just here. You can see that it's very, very shallow. So the arm joint, make out this is an arm joint, not a leg joint, sits there and it's held into place by all the muscles, not the joint. And it can easily be sprained and strained. Once again, repetitive strain injuries, painting ceilings, it's not good for the rotator cuff or your neck actually. I see a lot of that stuff with my painter decorator guys. And usually after a long periods of doing the same action, yeah? But with regards to the shoulder joint, it's really important that you understand that the shoulder joint is made up, we call it the shoulder girdle. It starts from your breastbone, through your clavicle, and of course through your shoulder blade. That part is called your shoulder girdle, and it's crucial. If you've got something happening with your scapula, it's going to affect your whole shoulder joint. And that also means the muscles that attach into the scapula, your rhomboids. Are people familiar with the rhomboids? They're little stingy bingies, because they're very, very difficult to get to. In order to get to those, you've got to displace the shoulder blade. And that means doing this. When you do that, you open up all that area and then you can get in and work. Both manipulating with hands, in my case, but as acupuncturists, you can use your needles to get into those difficult muscles of the rhomboids that are also associated with the shoulder girdle. Okay, so we talked about some of the attachments, and for example with the bicep, it attaches onto your clavicle and on your the front part of your shoulder blade bone. And if you get a little inflammation there, everything sets off and it's sore.
I had a friend who fell over recently and hurt. Dislocated.
Oh, a dislocation.
And they didn't put it back.
No, they don't.
And it's here. It kind of there's some sort of protrusion here now.
Yeah.
And they haven't put it back though.
But did she break the clavicle?
No, I don't know. I think she just. I don't think she broke it, but she dislocated it.
Okay, well, dislocation.
It's an anterior displacement.
Yeah, that's an anterior displacement. You've got to remember.
It's not gone back again. It's not gone
but
back.
But that's most probably because, you know, I don't know what kind of care that she was receiving or if she actually broken it. But whenever you do anything with the shoulder, it has consequences. Remember, this is a whole shoulder girdle. Your arm is just hanging off your rib cage because it's only held into place by the muscles, not the joint. I mean, the joint's important, but. The muscles holding the arm bones, the humerus in the shoulder is what holds it all together. And it's very easily displaced. I see a lot of issues with my football guys that play the rugby, is more importantly. They get anterior displacement. So that means the impact is from the front, and so the shoulder goes backwards like that. If they had breakages, that's difficult. But you've got to let the inflammation settle down, but then position. What they tend to do with any anterior displacement, as long as it's not a break, they put you in a collar and cuff. So they put you in a bandage where the weight of your arm pulls down on your shoulder joint and everything settles usually in place. They do that a lot with children when they break the humerus bone. Just the natural weight of the arm in place like this will set the healing. They don't normally put it in plaster unless there's more complications for that. Yeah? So, I just want to backtrack a little bit about inflammation when you hurt your shoulder. And we talk about a frozen shoulder. Frozen shoulders, they're horrible and they're very difficult to manage. The way that I manage them is with lots of manual therapy. I tend not to use acupuncture. I find it too, I don't use it because I find that the way that I manage it, it's a little bit easier. The acupuncture with frozen shoulder is great when you're working on the muscles, but not inside the joint capsule. And you have to keep manipulating and moving that shoulder so that you stop it from fibrosing. So the natural sequence with a frozen shoulder is that it usually gets triggered by a trauma or it just happens. There's no pattern for people, but when it starts happening, your shoulder is really painful, very deep pain. You get restriction in the movement, and then inside the joint capsule it starts tightening. We call it fibrosis, where everything tightens. And you can't move your shoulder, it's extremely painful. You can't lie on it, it keeps you awake. You can't do your hair, it's difficult to do your personal cares. But it has a natural sequence that it gets really, gradually gets bad, gets really bad, and then unfreezes. But that whole process.
So like 9 month process, is it? 9 month or 1 year?
It's usually, it gets worse over 6 to 9 months.
Yeah.
And then it's really bad, and then out of the blue, 2 years later, it just
goes away.
It's the same with plantar fasciitis.
So it's a kind of contraction in the socket joint.
It's inside the joint.
Yeah. Socket joint. It's not the ball.
It's in the actual joint capsule.
In the capsule.
Yeah. The fluid inside the synovial joint becomes thick and viscous, like honey, and that's where you get all the inflammation and restriction. It's really uncomfortable. Has anybody had a frozen shoulder? It's awful. There's a higher prevalence in women than it is with men.
Yeah.
Hi there. Just pass a little sheet.
Yep.
To the girl. Okay, so so I've talked about the stages. You've got the pre-adhesive stage, the acute adhesive stage, maturation, and then the chronic phase. So you've got lots of other things there with the shoulder, but I want to move down to the elbow joint. Because everybody's had a little tennis elbow or golfer's elbow. So one is lateral and one is lateral.
Lateral
is that way, sideway. Medial is inside to the body. All right, so that's another terminology that we need to just pay attention to. So And once again, it's all to do with overuse, repetitive strain stuff. Has anybody had a tennis elbow? Yeah, not pleasant. You can't even put your hand, your elbow down without having electric pain. And it's really intense. So moving forward, you got the comparisons of tennis and golfer's elbow. I talked about carpal tunnel before. Remember, it's a little tunnel in between your radius and your ulna. When that tunnel becomes tight, it puts pressure on the vessels, the veins, the nerves inside that little tunnel, and you get tingling.
Sometimes. Is there any particular fingers that you get the tingling in?
Well, it's the median nerve, and it could either be that side of the nerve or that side, but they're very distinctive. Do you want me to show you one of the tests? Oh, I should have put this one in. It's really easy. So, in order to diagnose a true carpal tunnel, you ask them to do, we call it a pheasant's test, but I'll say to people, do a little prayer for me. So if you ask your patients, your clients, to place their hands together and push their wrists in, if they get pain by doing that, that's a positive test. Yeah, we call it the Phelan's test, but then you've got to reverse. You ask them to, and remember, elbows have got to be parallel, and if you push into the wrist there, if you get a little pain again, or the symptoms, the tingling worsens, those are both positive tests for carpal tunnel. And you can do that with your patients and clients. Very easy. They're going to love you. They think, oh my God, they're so clever. Yeah? So that's a very simple test.
So, John, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you treat it very successfully?
Yeah, I do. But you know what? There's two areas of our body that have a beautiful rubber band like structure around them, and that's the wrist and your midfoot, just here. It goes right around. So those two areas, what I do, I have a lot of success with needling and also with soft tissue work. And if you can imagine, it's like a rubber band. If you've got tightness here, because that's what it is really, it's the reticulum.
Yeah, retinaculum, yeah.
It's the reticulum that tightens that causes the carpal tunnel. And the reticulum tightens because of inflammation. Inflammation's horrible because it causes all this tightening. What I do with my patients is I visualize that little soft hand. I visualize that rubber band. And what I do is I do a lot of soft tissue work like this, where I bring my thumbs together and draw out. Yeah? Why don't you practice this? Because this is actually...
So it's like stretching the reticulum.
Yeah, you're stretching the reticulum. And I actually have a lot of success with this with most of my patients. And I'll say about 70% where I do this. Yeah? And you know what else I do? Has everybody had a Kit Kat? You know what a Kit Kat is? You know how you break a Kit Kat off? Can you just stop that for a minute? Sorry. We can take it again. I need your wrist to show everybody. And I do a Kit Kat. So remember, we've got two bones. You've got your radius and your ulna. Radius is called radius because it rotates over. So you've got two heads of the forearm bones, ulna and radius. The heads are just there. And then you've got all your beautiful little wrist bones. You've got two rows of wrist bones. And I do Kit Kats, where I go like this. Yeah? Because what you're doing is you're mobilizing the two heads of the bones to encourage a little bit more blood flow and ease within that reticulum. I do a lot of this stuff, and I do a lot of stripping of the fascia.
Would you want to see them physically?
You know what I do? I get them to bring their husbands or partners in. I do it two times. And then I think, you know what? Enough is enough. They can go home and do it together. They need a bit of time together. And I always like empowering my patients to take over. And when I do that, I'm not suggesting that you do, but I think it's a good idea. When I do that, they have more respect for you because they're saving money too. And they love that. But you get more people talking about you and how wonderful you are and your practice, and you get more return. It's not always about the money. It's about being honest and true to your work and having good intention. Intention's crucial to all our work. I've not talked about intention with work, but I think this is a good time, maybe. I think we're going to divert a little bit. So
Yeah, go for it.
It's really important when you're a practitioner that you work with honesty. And I always talk about heart stuff, but I don't necessarily talk about it with my patients. But you've got to have a clear heart and a clear intention. When you work with ego, that can impede, that can stop you from seeing things that you need to see with your clients or your patients. When you work with arrogancy and ego, you're being really disrespectful to your patients. You're not looking at them as a whole person and considering why they're here with you. And I find that my approach with my patients, that's how I treat them. I don't always know that I'm giving them that little bit extra, that little bit extra love and support, because some people don't like that intimacy, level of intimacy. But I always keep my heart clear and my intention honest and open so that I can treat people and I get really good results the majority of the time.
Just like a spiritual moment that you're open and aware and you're listening and receiving what they're telling you.
Absolutely.
And you're not sort of
as you get on in time through experience, and I don't say that to make myself sound great or whatever, but when you touch and hold somebody, you feel their life force.
Mm.
And actually, I use that to guide me a lot in my work. I'm very lucky because I had a lot of experience as a nurse with people and observation and knowing a little bit more. But when you have that honesty in your work, when you deal with people, man, I think it's more powerful than the treatment.
Yeah, because they can feel that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then
they might not
you're
understand
open
it.
To make the right choice.
Yeah. The word love, really.
Yeah, no, you've got to have that. But I will never share that too much with my patients. I don't want to freak them out that I'm a pervert. But that's how I work. So I'm just sharing that with you personally.
It's about you being in the right spiritual state to give healing.
Absolutely. You know, I don't talk about those terms with my patients, like the healing stuff, because I'm regulated by my regulatory body, the General Council of Chiropractic, makes us all practice in a very medical model of care. I've got to respect that and always work that way, but it doesn't stop me from thinking and practicing how I want to practice. But what I'm saying that's really nice, over time, when you gain confidence in the work that you're doing, and I'm not saying that you're going to know everything all the time, and I don't. Sometimes I get thrown out, but what I do, I step away, I let, you know, do what I need to do with the patient, but I'll step away and I'll reflect on my practice. And I always think, what am I doing with that person? Am I doing the right thing? If I've got problems, I actually call Paul when it comes to some of the acupuncture stuff, so I'm not quite sure. Even after all these years, sometimes I have my little doubts. And, you know, it's fine to work with confidence, but when you have doubt, it means that the way that you're managing your clients, your patients, you're not sure, and that will transpire into the care that you give them. Sometimes you can wing it. You think, oh, no, let's try this, and you'll be fine. But I always like acting with caution, because you always got to put your patients, your clients first.
So in fact, that's something that all practitioners have in common, whether they speak about it or not.
Yeah.
That whether they're a doctor or a massage therapist or Tai Chi or whatever, that they are healers.
Yeah, they are.
And it's healing, and it may be using a belief system. It may be nothing to do with a belief system, but it's actually healers. And surgeons, everyone has that in common.
They do. But you know, everybody has their boundaries where they've got to work within, and I have mine. But when you work in that way, and I do work, I do follow that medical model, because you know I've got to think of all the variables. But when you follow that way of working, and that's the way I choose to work, and I work with a lot of intention in my heart, you know, it's really interesting. If I'm not feeling up to it, or if I feel like I'm a little bit tired, because I work hard. When, for example, tomorrow, I'm thinking, I had a heavy night last night, not drinking, but just singing and screaming and dancing lots. You know, I'm going to rest up today, but if I'm not right for tomorrow, it's incredible what the universe does to me. I have patience. Ping, 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm sick, I can't come. Fine. Ping, I need to reschedule, I've got work. The universe provides for us all. That's how I see it. And, you know, you then have a gap of 2 hours. And, you know, I do little naps. Yeah, when I've got gaps like that, I strip my bench, have a little nap, rejuvenate myself. And, you know, it, for me, it's like having a can of Coca-Cola. It's amazing. But that's how I work. Yeah, anyway.
Because you're fresh. When you wake up, you're fresh.
Yeah, exactly. And so we digressed a little
bit. Getting old.
But I don't mind digressing because, you know, I know that you guys are going to be amazing. And I always want to encourage good practice and always to be safe. But, you know, you'll find your own groove one day and it's beautiful. It really is nice. And when you can work with intention and love in your heart, you can look after people with honesty. You usually get it right. And it's a nice feeling because people talk. My best form of advertising, and I've done loads of advertising, is people. 93% of my work comes through word of mouth. The other 7% is from my internet. And I don't even like that stuff. Okay, look, I just found a better one.
Yeah.
Why didn't I have a look before? Okay, let's move on. So there's a whole lot of stuff that I missed out about the thorax. That's the TX. I'm going to leave you to that, work that one out. Very difficult to examine and to do the testing for because, you know, the main issues with the thoracic region is, you know, once again, overstretching, too much of this, or coughing too much. If you've got a bad cold, you get little sprains and strains in your back.
I've had intercostal neuralgia.
Yeah, and I have a lot of big busted girls, you know, the weight of big boobies pushing down on your chest. You can get little inflammation, and it's called postochondral inflammation. So with your ribs attach to your breastbone, which is bone, but to cartilage. So at these points, you've got these joints, where are costochondral joints. And if you've got big boobies, or you've done big coughs and that, you can actually set up inflammation at these little joints. And also at these little joints, and it is painful. I had a guy once, you know how you take car tires off with those, that crisscross thingy? You know, what is it called?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes. Well, crisscross spanner.
Yeah. He actually sprained his intercostal joints by doing that. And, like, what do I do with him? I thought, I can't ask him to wear a tighter bra. Because with my women, I get them to wear breast binders or use a really tight bra to hold their boobies in place so that they don't have so much movement. Because when you get inflammation here, it hurts. Because with the ribs, I always say that they're like rings of confidence. So your ribs articulate with your breastbone, but what else do they articulate? With your spine. And the spinal nerves from your thoracic region, so the nerves that give pain and stretch come from your spine, goes right around. So for example, 1, 2, 3, so T5. So the spinal nerve T5 that comes from here, that nerve goes right around. So if you've got pain here, you're going to have pain here. Yeah. And yes? Well, you've got to think about what the ribs do, firstly. You know, they house your lungs and heart and the major organs to your stomach. And your ribs have got beautiful muscles that go crisscross like that and straight down, up and down. But it's all to do with your breathing. So when you breathe, your diaphragm flattens because your diaphragm is a nice dome. When you take a breath in, your diaphragm flattens, it stretches open, your ribs go up and out. So that's how your lungs expand, yeah? And it changes pressure in your body. So if you've got pain here, breathing's going to be difficult. If you fracture a rib, it can be life-threatening if the fracture, like this guy, he's got a fracture. If that fracture punctures a rib, you get a pneumothorax.
So that means
the puncture of the lung, and that lung collapses. And when that lung collapses, you get a shift across, so you can squash your heart with the shift from the pressure inside the chest. So those are some of the issues with the thorax, the bones in the thorax. But yeah, if you get a sprain or strain from coughing too much is really painful, or if you fracture your rib, very painful. You can't do anything. You've got to breathe still.
And also, John, that's why that when somebody has a hiatus hernia, that when the stomach is protruding up through the diaphragm, the T5 is the area when they get a lot of pain.
Yes, they do. So it's a referral.
Sometimes it's a referral pain. Mm. So a lot of people that come in, you know, and they've actually had their back looked at, and they think it's to do with the shoulders. It's actually, again, can be because of that. So
absolutely.
In that aspect, then the pain there goes. Yeah.
Yes, you're right.
If it's the costal chondral inflammation part, would it be more of like a dull ache then? Or would it
it's really deep. It's very deep and it hurts a lot. It's persistent. But remember, everybody's different. Mm. Yeah, I have patients who've got these incredible pain thresholds. And they I would be screaming and rolling around the ground and they're okay. Everybody's different. But I need to always think outside the box. And once again, costal, when you have that type of inflammation, acupuncture is really good. Yeah. Yes.
Does inflammation only related to breast implant?
You know, you've got to know what breast implants are. It's a foreign body placed inside your body. It's a foreign body placed in the body, and one in nine of my female patients have breast implants. It's very popular. I try not to judge, but I actually don't do any work on women's ribs when they've got implants because I don't want to be responsible for a possible rupture. And I don't know if you're familiar, about 7 years ago there was a lot of scandals with regards to the PRP implants that were being manufactured by a company in France. The distributor was in Northwood, which hospital you're aware of. And they were supplying this one particular private hospital called Bishop. Oh, it doesn't matter, I can tell you. It's in the papers. Bishopswood Hospital. The seven plastic surgeons there, they got on the bandwagon and started sticking these things into women. Bang, bang, bang. And so when this whole scandal came up, because with that particular implant, it was the silicon that they used inside that was industrial grade silicon. And industrial grade silicon can perforate or change the outer covering very quickly and you get leakage. So what the hospital it's a little bit of a story. So what the hospital chose to do is to recall all 122 women. Remember how I said there was 124? There were two, you know, transsexuals involved, you know, they're included. They invited them all back to have their old implants out and new ones put in. Because when you put an implant in, your body would react around it and cause a capsule around it. And the thing with some implant, well, with any implant, with breast implants, when you first have them put in, you've got to look after them. So I used to train my women to do, I'll show you. I always used to train my women to do 10 seconds in, 10 seconds out, 10 seconds down, 10 seconds up. Because if you don't, there's a high risk of fibrosis around the implants where the skin contracts really hard and it can be very disfiguring. But with implants, anything artificial in your body, you always run the risk of rupture, but putting pressure on other structures. I don't say to women, you know, don't get them done, but try and get something that's natural for your body. Now, in plastic surgery with breast implants, we always train about lift-off. You know how natural boobies have a lift-off instead of having big implants? Because when you have really big implants, it puts pressure on lots of other structures.
Because I see a lot when they have breast implants, they have the pain underneath.
Oh, yeah, it's horrible.
And it's always related on the back. So always,
but that's when you get the referred.
So it would be inflammation?
It's most probably pressure on that rib at the front. Remember how we said that the nerve to that rib innervates from your spine? You get referred pain. Anything artificial, I'm a little bit funny about, but I try not to make my ladies or my men feel bad that they've got them. Because, you know, sometimes, you know, when it comes to breast tissue and women, you know, if you've had a mastectomy, if you're really unhappy, and you know, there's always a place for that stuff. And I find it very interesting too, the reconstructive surgery. Any other questions about ribs?
What I was going to say is, when you do your consultation, I think it's a very good idea to ask women whether they have breast implants or not, because things like the lung formula or the liver 14, there is a chance that you could puncture the silicone. So you should really always ask that to be sure.
They're changing, I don't know, well, now we're on the subject of breast implants, but they're changing a lot of the insides of breast implants to oil, like a natural soy oil or sunflower oil. They're changing, they're moving away from silicone, and they're using more oil and saline. So if you do get rupture, it doesn't cause a problem. Remember we talked about those 124 people, women mainly, and two men that had the implants put in at Bishopswood Hospital? They took out all 124, and only five of them had ruptures. But when you have rupture, it's horrible, because it leaks into tissues around your body, and you can't clean it up. And there's been evidence that's shown when you have that sort of leakage, it sets up autoimmune responses. For example, your own body's fighting that foreign thing, and it sets up other inflammation processes like fibromyalgia, ME, and you'll see all that stuff in your work. Very difficult to manage because you've got the psychological component as well as the autoimmune system. And there's lots of things that we can do as acupuncturists to support the immunity, with needling, but also with herbs. Anyway, we're digressing again, and I'm really good at doing all that stuff. So we're moving down to the spine. I've been asked to talk a little bit about disc herniation, and I just want to show you where the discs are. Now, we're looking at the lumbar spine here. Remember, there's five vertebrae in the lumbar spine. And then all throughout your whole spine, you've got these beautiful shock absorbers. They're called discs, intervertebral discs. And as you go down the spine, they get bigger. Why do you think they get bigger as you go down the spine? Yeah. But these are the major weight-bearing vertebra of the spine. So when we're upright, our weight goes through our spine, hits the lumbar region, goes into the pelvis, down our legs. So the weight is dissipated. It moves from the spine to the pelvis, down our legs. So the major weight-bearing joints in our body, what do you think they are? What do you think they are?
The knees.
The knees, right? The hips. And the lumbar spine. So these are the areas that get a lot of wear and tear. Now, that wear and tear can be increased by certain things. What things do you think could make a difference to these big bones here?
And excess weight.
Yeah. It's a very delicate subject when you're discussing that sort of thing with patients. So, for example, when most men and women, when they put weight on, ladies tend to put weight here, here, here. Men tend to sort of focus on here. So, your belly button, everybody's got one, unless you've had a hysterectomy, a tummy tuck, it's different. But your center of gravity is your umbilicus, your belly button. So if your belly button is out here, your center of gravity has changed. And that means you want to do that. So what does that do? That increases the lumbar curvature. It's called lordosis. It increases your lordosis. So if you increase your lordosis, it changes and puts more pressure on these discs, and lots of wear and tear, abnormal wear and tear. So with my patients, apart from adjusting them, I try and support them and encourage them about, I don't talk diets. People, when they hear diets, they switch off. We talk about portion control. I like portion control, it works well for me. Just to get people thinking about it. We're in very interesting positions, so we can put little seeds in people's minds, and then they can make changes, hopefully. So, yeah, being overweight is one of the reasons that causes strain on those joints.
Childbirth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you've had two babies. Yeah, no, you get all that. when you've got a growing fetus, once again, it changes your center of gravity, and you want to do this more.
You can get anterior slippage.
Anyway, I heard that it doesn't really ever go quite back.
You know what, with pregnancy, you've got to remember, Katie, that you have, after the first trimester, that's the first 3 months, your body's producing lots of hormone called relaxin in your pregnancy to make your muscles and joints a little bit more pliable so you can deliver. And then after you deliver, that stabilizes over 6 months and you're not quite the same, of course not. But you can do stuff to help strengthen it. We've talked about collagen last time. I have a little theory because, you know, I think I mentioned to you, I see a lot of children with these big heads and small little mouths and little jaws. It's really weird. And like they're really bendy. They look like old people, but they're hypermobile. And I think it's because we don't have enough collagen in our diet. People aren't drinking boiled chicken broth. And so I'm always suggesting, boil up that roast chicken bones and make some soup. Or, you know, do the same with some beef bones, fish bones. In China, the incidence of hypermobility is really low, and also arthritis. And I'm sure it's linked to their diet. Yeah. Why am I telling you that for?
Don't know, but a lot of people are into that at the moment, chopping up bones and having that.
Yeah,
and it's very good for the joints, very good for the skin.
Yeah, no, of course. So, Paul just reminded me. You know, you can get translation, movement of these vertebrae if you've got instability of your discs. Now, your discs are beautiful. They're really spongy and they're gelatinous and they've got fibers that go round and fibers that crisscross. If you get a weakness and with the attachment, the vertebra can move forward. So, what does the spine do? The spine houses the spinal cord, and it's inside. You can't quite see it. So if you've got movement forward, what's that going to do? It's going to put pressure on the spinal cord. It's a medical emergency. Yeah, you get a lot of pain to begin with. You get abnormal sensation in your genital area, your bottom. You can't pee properly, or you get incontinent of your urine and your feces. These are signs and symptoms of lower back issues that we don't ignore. They're a medical emergency. They need to move to go to A&E. Yeah?
I have a question regarding epidural.
Yeah.
Yeah. How damage can it make to the...
You know, there's always a risk factor with spinal epidurals and spinal blocks because you're piercing the outer layer of the spinal cord in order to get the fluid in, usually pain relief in, so that an anesthetic to numb the area for delivery or to numb the area for pain control.
And this pressing is staying forever, isn't it?
Yes, there's a risk for some people. You know, I've had patients who've had issues with that during, they have an epidural placed and an infusion given in preparation for delivery, for either a cesarean section or normal delivery, and they get a little tear in the dura. The dura is the first lining to the spinal cord. You've got three linings. And when you get that tear and it doesn't heal, you get fluid shifting between the layers, and that's why you get a little residual problem. I just say, you know, just keep moving, manage your discomfort if you've got it.
Pilates is helpful.
Yeah, you've got to keep moving. You know, movement and stretch is crucial. If you have pain, you've got to keep moving it. You've got to keep stretching it.
Yeah.
The moment you stop, you contract and you get more of a problem. Okay.
Can you mention about subluxation and fixation?
Yes, of course. That's a whole thing with my work. So when we talk about subluxation, it can occur throughout your whole body, but it means where the joint doesn't sit nicely. So, I need to demonstrate it somewhere. Okay, so if you've got a subluxation in your lumbar spine, it can be like this, where the vertebrae on the top and the bottom don't sit nicely. So you can see that if it's subluxed or there's a subluxation, if you've got one vertebra going one way and one the other, it's going to put pressure on that yellow nerve, that spinal nerve. So when if you've got pressure on a spinal nerve, it causes dis-ease. So that level, at level 3, 4, this is lumbar 5, lumbar 4, lumbar 3. When you have pressure on this spinal nerve, that will go to your hip and your upper thigh. So that means you could have symptoms of groin pain. But at the same time, if you've got groin pain, you've got to think, could it be an inguinal hernia? Or it could be a groin strain from football. So in my world, everything's about the nerves and the mapping of the nerves. And with subluxations, it can be caused skeletally, like a problem with the vertebra, not lying properly. Or you can have a subluxation here. That would, oh no, if you say T5, if you have a subluxation at T5, either at your rib or at the back, that nerve also goes to your stomach. So you can get indigestions type things. When I work with my patients, I always say to them, these spinal nerves are amazing. They go to every part of your body, the muscles and bones and joints and ligaments, but also the organs in your body. So the organs in your chest, your heart, your lungs, your stomach. And then, of course, your organs in your abdomen, that's your small bowel and part of your large bowel. And then as you go into the pelvic area, it's your large bowel, genital area. So when you talk about spinal nerves, you've got to remember that spinal nerves innervate muscle, bone, joint, ligaments, but also the organs. So the same nerve, lumbar 3, that's causing you to have groin pain, can also be affecting your bladder or your large bowel. The lower you go, for example, lumbar 5 and S1, that sacrum one, these two go to your large bowel, your rectum. So you can get dis-ease or discomfort with that. And then of course, sacral number 2 goes to your genital area and your perineum. And when you have symptoms associated with that, subluxation, it means you can have loss of sensation, tingling, incontinence, problems with your saddle paresthesis. You know that area that you sit on a saddle? If you have any patients or clients with that sort of problem, it's a medical emergency. I just send them off to A&E because that's a medical emergency. Those nerves are having direct pressure on them. And nerves are really funny things. If they get a bruise, if they've got pressure on them, you can take away the pressure, but you'll still feel that bruise for weeks, months later. And sometimes if you don't remove the compression, the pressure on the nerve, your symptoms are permanent.
Is it cell memory?
No, it's not. So it's all mechanical.
Right.
Yeah, it's all mechanical.
So that's why it's good to do repetitive treatments after you've put the positioning back. So repetitive treatments.
Well, the reason being is muscle has. We haven't talked about this. I talked about the structure of muscles, but as therapists, you've got to understand that muscle has memory, and everybody understands it because of the way that the muscles are fibers are structured. So on a macroscopic level, like really tiny microscopic level, your muscle fibers are on springs. So these are the springs. So the fibers go from one spring to the other. So when you have a subluxation, your muscles adjust around that misaligned bone and joint. As therapists, acupuncturists, manipulators, chiropractors, osteopaths, physios, we all understand that relationship with the muscle fibers. So when you adjust, treat, needle, you create a change in the muscle to create the change to the bone and joint beneath that it all attaches to. Does that make sense? So, but muscle has memory. If you do all your work and then that person goes out for a jog or sits in a hot bath or jacuzzi or one of those hot tub things, who wants to sit in other people's muck, you know, or your muscle memory goes back to where it was. So when I work with my chiropractic patients, I always say to them, no exercise, no housework, no long distance driving, drink plenty of water, try and avoid the alcohol, try and avoid tea and coffee, because tea, coffee, alcohol in my world are toxins. And whenever you adjust somebody as a chiropractor, as an acupuncturist, you're stimulating the lymphatic system. You can't just treat somebody and not consider the other systems. When I treat somebody, if I make an adjustment, there's always a nerve, a blood supply, a lymphatic drainage. It's the same in acupuncture. You will create a change in all three systems. So that's why we avoid toxins. So after a treatment, water. Dilutes the lymphatics, because you're pushing lymph into the circulatory system and you want to decrease that amount. Otherwise they get headaches. They get headaches with acupuncture, they get headaches with chiropractic, with physio, with massage even. So you get them to come back within 3 to 7 days, because you need to break that pattern in the muscle memory. So they might come back to you 7 days later and they say, oh, I've got that pain a little bit, but it's not as bad, but it's still there. You've got to treat consecutively, usually three times over 3 weeks. And I do the same with acupuncture, because you want to change that muscle memory. Our body's got an amazing way of going back to how it was. So do you understand that? It's not a concept, it's a fact. Muscle has memory, so when your patients, your clients come to you, they're like this. When you treat, you change the position of the bone, the muscle, the bone through to the joint. And you get them back again the next time, usually 5 to 7 days later. If they're acute, that means they're really in a lot of pain, I get them back within 3-4 days, and you adjust again or treat again. Sometimes I do both acupuncture and chiropractic, because it strengthens the outcome. As long as they can cope, this can be quite strong to stop that muscle memory. If anything out of today is to remember that bit.
Do you think the body in general has a kind of memory? Because people get things and they tend to come back.
Yeah, of
you
course.
Know, this kind of memory.
Yeah, but I actually think that's got to do with also the person's psyche. But people tend not to break patterns in themselves, psychologically, physically. We all have our own patterns. Well, I've got my little patterns just standing here. I'm always like this. But that's because, I don't know why. Our work is to break patterns, because if you break patterns, you stop the disease or the pain, the discomfort, and it's getting their bodies to connect with their brain and their bodies to make the change.
Is there a difference between subluxation and fixation?
Not really.
Same thing.
Same thing. Right. Except with the fixation, you can get spasming.
Okay, so that's the difference.
And that holds it in. But once again, with acupuncture, you can break that spasming around a joint. It's really effective. But in my work, I do lots of things. Firstly, I adjust. Secondly, I do the acupuncture. And then I add all my other stuff, myofascial release work, the trigger pointing. That's stuff that you can add to your toolbox when you're a practitioner. Because your learning never stops. Okay, where are we time-wise? Ah!
No, you're right.
Okay, listen, there's lots more in there. But there's another thing that I just want to point out that we've added to the lecture notes, and that's on scoliosis. I've given you a very, very detailed thing. But I'm not going to go into it right now. But one thing I want to say to you is that another test that you can do on anybody, and a lot of you've got kids, and a lot of you've got grandchildren maybe, or whatever, or friends. There's one test when you see somebody, you can always tell somebody when somebody's not quite right. You don't have to be an expert. You know, I love going and looking at people in shopping malls and stuff, because I sit there sometimes just to, you know, take it all in. And you see how people walk or how they hold themselves. And you know, you see people that are, you know, it's true, I'm a bit obsessive about body position. But you see people and they're like this. And if they're really big, it's even more noticeable, or if they're very skinny. They're like, they've got a corkscrew presentation of their body, and they're talking to you like this, and you think, far out, what's happened in your life? With scoliosis, you see a lot of that, and you see the unbalanced stuff. If you're right-sided dominant, which I am on the top, I'm left-sided dominant on the bottom, so it's a bit skew-whiff. I have a gentle rotation, it's like that. I have a gentle one. But with scoliosis, it can be very defined or very, very subtle. And in my world as a chiropractor, I'm always looking at the adolescents, the kids. Girls grow really, really fast, very quickly at, you know, from the age of like 11 to 13. Girls grow really quick because that's their timing, whereas boys are a little bit different. They're a slow burn to start with, and then they grow quick. And there's a lot of reasons why people have scoliosis. One of them is genetic predisposition, so it's in the family somewhere. Or they grow up really quickly, and that is usually called idiopathic scoliosis. Because you know when you grow, I don't know if you're aware of this, but your bones, the long bones, these guys, they grow really, really, really fast, but not at the same rate as the muscles attaching to them. So if you're looking at a developing young person, adolescent, if they're growing fast, and including the size of these vertebra bones, the neck bones, the head, the pelvis, when they're growing fast, all the little attachments of the muscles here and the beautiful longitudinal muscle that attaches there on either side of the spine, when you're growing fast and your bones are growing fast, the muscles don't grow at the same rate, neither do the nerves. So you get imbalances with the muscles to the bones. And that is one of the theories about idiopathic adolescent scoliosis developing. So we covered one little test that we're for carpal tunnel. To remember, you know, the prayer and the reverse prayer. One of the other tests for scoliosis that you need to know, so you can detect, because there's very little that you can do with scoliosis, but you can influence change in young people enormously when they're growing. So can I just say, who's a tall person? You're tall, aren't you? Can I get you to stand up?
No, but you're a big person, so you can take your top off.
So what we do, because
can everybody see?
Yes. Des, just turn and face the wall. So, okay, Des, he's got lots of muscle bulk here, lots of hair. But if you can imagine him as a young person, when you want to do some diagnostic work, or even an older person, this is the test that you need to do to see if they've got a scoliosis. Okay, so you stand behind them and you just look. And you can see that his left shoulder, let me just turn that way actually. You can see that his left shoulder is a little bit higher than his right. And that's a telltale sign that he's right-sided dominant. If you're right-sided dominant, your shoulder's a little bit, yeah, there's nothing, I had to check it, it's true. You can see that his shoulder's a little bit lower. That's normal, yeah? Don't worry if it's too big, but it's just fine. And he'll have more muscle bulk on this side than it would on this side. But if you want to see whether or not somebody's got a scoliosis, if it's very, very subtle, you get them to do an Adam's test. So when I do an Adam's test, I always stand behind the patient to fixate their hip and ask them to bend forward. Just bend forward. Maybe right down. And you look to see whether or not there's a higher point there or a higher point there. Somewhere. Yeah? It's very, very simple. Thank you. Take a seat. Very, very simple.
10 minutes.
Yeah, okay, we've got to get going. So,
higher point on the center?
It depends where the curve is. Now, with scoliosis, you normally have a compensatory curve. So when you look at your young people or your family, look at the girls in their bikinis, or the boys in their shorts when they got, you know, at the beach or at the pool. And if they're bending forward and they're like this, it means that they've got a scoliosis. And usually if they're slim, you can see it. With my work, I can feel it. And it's usually quite obvious. So if you see a young person like that, you've got to inform them and they've got to have their scoliosis measured and monitored. Usually, most of the time, the kids grow out of it. There are some kids that don't. And they're the ones that usually grow really, really tall and that. Okay. What do you want to do?
Just carry on okay, for so, about 10 minutes left, that's all.
Yeah, no. The other, there's lots of stuff there on your hip, on your knee. But what I wanted to just, because you'll see a lot of this with regards to Achilles tendon. When you have Achilles tendonitis, very uncomfortable. And usually when you have Achilles tendonitis, it sets up other problems. So remember how we talked about if you've got a problem somewhere here, it'll be referred to your knee. If you've got a problem with your knee, either it goes up to your hip or to your ankle. When you have problems with the Achilles, it usually goes into your ankle, into your foot. So you just got to remember, you can't have a problem here without affecting here, and vice versa. There's always a consequence. If you have a discomfort or a problem with the joint, above and below, there's going to be a change because of the change in the biomechanics of that joint. Yeah? With Achilles tendonitis, you know, we're trained as acupuncturists never to do any needling into a tendon. Because, why do you think that? Does anybody know why? There's very little blood supply in a tendon. So this is one of the safety things that we need to talk about with regards to Achilles tendonitis. We don't do direct needling unless it's further up into the gastrocnemius muscle, or the psoas muscle, which are the muscles of the calf that blend into one. That's where we do it. And when I do work around the Achilles tendon, I do it all on the sides.
Yeah, yeah. Like bladder 10 and kidney 3. Just put whole loads of needles in around that area. That's special.
And with the knee problems, the only time I actually needle a tendon is the patella tendon, because it's quite it's fine to do so. That's what we've been taught. But wherever there's a tendon, be very careful. Because when I do work with people who have got tendonitis of the bicep tendon, remember there's two points, I needle around it. Likewise with the acromial clavicular joint, I needle around it, not directly into the tendon. Because you want to set up inflammation process to heal. That's how I explain it to my patients. In traditional Chinese medicine, it's different. Yeah, we follow the meridians and the points. Now, Paul and I were discussing before we started the other precautions that we've got to talk about whenever it comes to acupuncture and joints is that we never do any needling where there's a joint replacement or a fracture. But in some cases we can, but that's done in consultation with the patient and you discuss risk factors. Because whenever you needle near a prosthetic device, that means an artificial joint, you can always cause an inflammation process or infection. You know, that's one of the risk factors with acupuncture is infection, bleeding, bruising. Yeah, and we always ask our patients what their bleeding tendencies are like, what kind of medication they're on, including Chinese herbs, because there are some Chinese herbs that make you bleed a little bit more, so you need to weigh out the pros and cons. I treat a lot of people that are on aspirin to reduce their risk factors for stroke, and I've got to weigh up whether or not doing acupuncture, you know, on their knee or their elbow is beneficial, outweighs the risk factors associated with bleeding. And so I just tell them. You know,
warfarin as well, warfarin.
Yeah, warfarin, aspirin, and other blood thinning drugs. And sometimes people have conditions that affects their clotting. So be thoughtful with needling anywhere where there's an artificial joint, we don't do it. And if you're going to do a tendon, we don't needle through tendons unless you outweigh the contraindications. Yeah, because of the blood supply, there is very little. I've seen patients who've been to physios who've done dry needling with the Achilles tendinopathy, and then the tendon just snaps. Yeah. If you can just think about the Achilles tendon in particular, it's like a rope. It frays and becomes very thin, and you're only left with a few strands. You just need one thing and it just goes. Very difficult to manage. Okay, so Paul asked me to include gout in our notes this year. It's self-explanatory, but you need to understand what gout is. I've given you a very good explanation of that. And once again, you know, you've got to weigh up whether or not I actually treat people with gout with needling to set up more inflammation for more healing, but it's really uncomfortable. Likewise with plantar fasciitis. In Western medicine, they see dry needling as a way of setting up inflammation to send more cells that your body produces in response to inflammation to heal. So that's how I explain it to my patients. And yeah, if you've got any questions, you've got my email at the front, or there's Paul or Annie to go through things with you. Is there anything you want to ask me? Yes.
John, have you ever heard of divers decompression chambers being used for people's spines?
Yeah. You know, I actually did a lot of work when I did burn surgery. We use the hyperbaric chambers to saturate people's bodies with high doses of high concentration of oxygen. That's what it is. Saturates the body with high concentrations of oxygen to encourage healing. I've not heard them use it with spinal stuff because that puts more pressure on the spinal cord, I believe, but it's not an area that I've heard used. Yeah, but that's to do with vascular supply. By saturating lots of oxygen into the blood system, it means that your body's got more oxygen for healing. Yeah. Remember, oxygen is used as part of the healing process, and we need it. Anything else? Yes?
You said normally ask your patient to drink water after the treatment.
Yes.
How bad is it if the patient comes on the night, like alcohol, caffeine?
It depends on everybody. Everybody's different. But part of my job is to give people information and risk factors and to get the most out of their treatment. You don't want to feel like worse than what you are. Everybody tends to feel, even with acupuncture, they feel more unsettled immediately after a treatment than they do better. But then after 24 hours, the changes are occurring straight away. But it's that first 24 hours. You want to decrease the amount of stress upon their body. So if you're doing tea, coffee, alcohol, that's more stress on the liver, which means more stress on the healing process that you're trying to encourage through acupuncture and chiropractic.
But in general, do you recommend them to stop drinking caffeine?
Yes, I tell them.
Alcohol completely?
No, just for that day, 24 hours. Yeah, and no cleaning the house. Huh? Yeah, no, I say you've got time off, no cleaning the house, no housework, no long distance driving.
No exercise, yeah.
Pardon?
Exercise,
yeah, anything where your body gets too hot, because that heats up the muscles, and the muscles will revert. Remember we talked about muscle memory? It will revert back to how the patient first presented.
But if you are having the course of treatment,
yes,
it's better not to drink caffeine.
You know, of course it is. It's great too, but human nature is that they want to...
Actually, that reminded me, my teacher used to recommend people not to have sex.
Because
that's quite a traumatic experience, straight after acupuncture,
oh, yeah,
after treatment,
God.
So it can actually reduce the healing effect.
When I work with both sexes, men and women, especially when they're having lumbar problems, they never ask me this, but I always say to them, you know, if you're going to have any intimacy, you need to be gentle. And they look at you and they think, what does it mean, gentle? And like you can see the cogs are working. And I just say to them, you know, sidelining. You know, sidelining, you know, trying to avoid very aggressive intimacy positions. Yeah.
I think we got ended there because...
Yeah, no. What a way to finish our discussion. You've got me all embarrassed now. Anyway, so if you need any more information, you can contact me. Otherwise... I'll be seeing you in the new academic year. Hopefully, we've got to work out a time.
Yeah, later on in the year, we're going to do this cardiovascular and blood thing.
Yeah.
We're working on it now, and I'll let you know, or I'll put it on the website when we get it ready.
Easy.
It will coincide, either with the blood stasis topic or with the cardiovascular topic, because it's related to those topics.
All right. Good. Excellent.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
Okay, listen.